Welcome everyone to another Jesuit Experience podcast. Today we have a special podcast planned. We're going to have a debate between two varsity debaters here at Jesuit, Luke and Peter. Griffin's going to give a brief introduction to both of them.
You know what? Let's do a little spin. Luke, start it off.
Hey, yeah, man. I can... you want me to just...
Tell us about yourself.
Okay, so my name is Luke. I'm a junior here. I'm basically Jesuit's resident libertarian, I would say. Varsity debate team, year three going on strong. I am in the musicians union, and not really anything else significant.
Peter,
what's going on? Pleasure to be here, y'all. I'm Peter Lowe, current senior at Jesuit College Prep. I'm on the varsity debate team. I am a debate partner with Luke Lastelik, meaning we compete together as a team of two in local, regional, state, and national competitions. I'm also senior viewpoint editor on the Jesuit Roundup, and I'm president of the Chinese Mandarin Club.
All right. We're glad we get to have you guys. It's going to be, you know, fun, a little chaotic, and I'm looking forward to it, Ben.
Yeah, so the way this is going to work, each of them is going to get 3 minutes to sort of sell you on their viewpoint, I guess, their political viewpoint, and then have a chance to refute the other's points, and then it's going to be a sort of open discussion where me and Griffin sort of moderate and just ask questions about their arguments.
Before we get started, Peter, for the audience purpose, explain what you and Luke are going to debate about.
So this debate is going to be about libertarianism versus a defense of the state. Luke, as he explained above, is an ardent libertarian. He believes that the best government is a small government, or that there should be no government. I believe in the authority of the state to protect the common good. That can be large government, kind of moderately sized government. It's on a spectrum, but I hope that clarifies the situation a little bit.
Awesome.
Ready to go?
Yeah, man.
Let's go.
Yeah, all right. So I want to open by saying that Peter will try to call me an anarcho-capitalist for the duration of this debate. I want to clarify some things. An anarcho-capitalist is somebody who believes that we can exist in peaceful harmony of free market capitalism and contractual voluntary agreements governed by property rights and the non-aggression principle, which is basically pacifism. Well, I generally believe that this is preferable to the corrupt system of the status quo. I personally don't advocate explicitly for it. I think it's a slippery slope to that ideology if you accept my way of thinking, however. I just don't think it's practical, possible, or realistic. Libertarianism, however, I believe, is the most potent political ideology today, or at least one of them. I think Australian New South Wales Legislative Council member John Ruddock put it best when he said, "Everybody agrees with us in hindsight." Generally from free markets to war and taxes, yes, even taxes, everybody wants what's in the favor of the common good, freedom, again, generally, even abortion and gun regulations see libertarians on both sides. I define libertarian as anyone who believes in freedom intrinsically or practically, and that can be disaggregated, but I think generally people will refer to the idea of limited government, which is what I will advocate for, as minarchism. Notice the adjacency to anarchism, where Peter will draw his snark from. I began my article I wrote in the Roundup not too long ago with a short story I partly wrote and partly borrowed from the late great Murray Rothbard. I used metaphor to synonymize taxation with theft. What I was doing here was not to try to portray the government as always evil, but to illustrate how actions the government engages in are not always indefensible, or are almost always indefensible, unless in support generally of general provisions of freedom and almost nothing else. Despite the potential need for a governing structure, I think it's good to discredit generally the idea that we need a government as it exists now, falsely representative, opaquely democratic, and furtively a separate entity from that of the individual, or as we have homogenized them now, society. So quickly, my two-pronged indictment of state coercion is first that the state is theoretically and morally illegitimate. It erodes the distinction between the public and the private by inserting itself into the realm of the individual, sucking up freedoms. In doing so, it corrupts and distorts the markets, which are the harbingers of independence. It infringes on the three core principles inherent to the individual: life, liberty, and property, a Lockean provision most of us agree on. However, I think this is partially regrettable because it ignores how individual communities may, for example, disagree with the idea of property rights. And so that's why I think that while coercion could be justified by moral goods of the government, of government actions, I think that while there are downsides, necessarily, the second part of my argument, which is that the government is just empirically wrong is preferable, because I think that the numerous examples provide the empirics for indictment of state engagement with the market, from the price of goods for subsidized industries like electric cars and farms, the failure of the FDA to allow beneficial drugs into the country, to the nightmare of the war on drugs, the government has failed us. Its power prevents lobbying and is the only thing actually enabling greed to transform into monopoly and corporate oppression, absent free markets, checks, and balances.
Wow.
All right. Great timing,
I'll say.
All right, Peter.
Let's hear it, Peter.
Awesome. So my defense of the state is that I defend the jurisdiction of a just and defensible government that exists by the people and for the people in order to protect the common good of society. I think that government is absolutely necessary for the greater good of said community. Coercion, as Luke puts it, can in fact be justified, especially if it's proven that the government has been a net positive to society. In my article, I outlined a thesis that I believe broadly encapsulates my opinions of the government, in that when government is run right, when it is democratic, when it's representative, can serve as a philanthropic institution that protects the governed body. Only the government can solve existential threats against humanity through its marshaling of resources and people, through the use of institutions which singular communities or individual actors cannot do. The government, by nature of having so many people work with and through it, is the only institution that can respond to threats to the greater good, or as St. Thomas Aquinas puts it, to the common weal. A decentralized and toothless federal power, otherwise known as just a small government, has been proven throughout history to fail to ensure the safety of its citizens or to properly address threats to national stability. I think at the end of the day, arguments that insert government was totalitarian or that it was unjust may be true. Obviously, there have been very, very awful governments throughout history. My argument is that the representative democracy I see in the United States today is one of the best forms of government we can have, and proves why the state is overall a net good to society. In my article, I outlined a philosophical defense of the state coming from theologians and philosophers such as St. Thomas Aquinas and the Roman orator Marcus Tullius Cicero, as well as John Locke, who Luke cites in his opening statement as being a defender of individual liberty, which is true, but these philosophers also realize, quite wisely I may add, that there must be a leader in society to direct the ability for a community to move forward in solving threats, increasing representation to people, or ensuring the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. I think that the state does have, through these beneficial characteristics of it, the ability and the just jurisdiction to tax, to levy resources from the population, to commit itself to conflicts, as long as these are supported by the legislature, which is elected by the people, or the people themselves. Arguments that the government is incompetent or that it's unjust are just, they're inevitable features of a government, but singular instances of failure do not justify a total rejection of the state as an institution.
Goodness gracious. Well, where do we start?
Refutation time?
How do you guys want questions?
Questions?
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, Peter. I think what you guys did was awesome. And I, by all means, could not present 3 minutes of my time and brainstorm research and come up with, you know, an answer. But for Peter, you tied a lot of things into a lot of our theology classes. I see why you align with that, but more importantly, why do you think, as a country, why do you think we have to reach for the common good? Why is there a bigger purpose than that? What makes you align with that concept?
So I think that the government has a unique ability to see beyond near-term desires or short-term events. I think humans, we're all rational creatures, but I do think individual humans fall victim to the problem of where we focus too much on the short term, and we do not, in the long term, address current threats or things that are beyond our knowledge. The government, because it's made up of multiple people, can marshal things like scientists, it can marshal the military, it can marshal all these accumulative, I guess, like literally biomass of people to solve issues. That is what is like the greater good, right? It's like solving stability of the nation, the U.S. marshaling resources during World War II to protect Europe and Asia and itself from existential conflict is an example of that.
Absolutely.
That is the greater good right there. Only the government can do that, because only the government has the foresight and the mechanisms to actually execute action to solve for something that's just beyond the horizon of what humans can perceive or understand.
Luke, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Unless you want to respond to what you said.
Yeah, I would like to get my comments if you don't mind. So it seems that what's underlying Peter's defense of the government is that we need a body to basically do everything that the people can.
Absolutely.
And yes, that sounds to me a little bit like socialism, which I'm sure you wouldn't defend, but I would like to point to basically every example in history of where the government has failed to do such a thing, with the exception of countries like Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia, where they were able to indeed move mass resources to defend the country, but not the people. So I think it's really a question of whether or not people in their natural state can do this without the government imposing themselves. And I think that they can. And that's sort of the justification for anarchism. But I do think that we can have a government that simply sets the guidelines by providing a court system, a prison system, and a military, basically only to prevent interpersonal and external coercion, because that provides the basis for local cooperation. I think institutional loyalty and civic cooperation is the best way for democratically things to happen. I don't think that needs to be, there doesn't need to be a government, but there needs to be some sort of cooperation between the citizens. I think that at the local level, this could come in the form of maybe establishing a smaller representative government, people working with institutions, things like Social Security or health benefits or whatever that you may, that Peter may defend, could certainly be done locally by people democratically at the smallest level, because what it really comes down to is a question of what is tyrannical, and tyranny is limited by smaller states empirically, such as the case with Ireland, Luxembourg, Singapore, the most economically free countries in the world. And again, if we're striving for what's best for the people, the most democratic thing is to let them do what they want. And I'm sure Peter wouldn't argue that everybody in this country believes that we need a government, but everybody believes in some sort of ordering system, and to allow those people to choose what they want, whether that be anything from anarcho-capitalism aforementioned or even anarcho-communism. I think that that is preferable to a system where we have a big government that has everything elected by a couple bureaucrats, that is non-falsifiable and lacks checks and balances.
I have answers. Can I say
them? Well, yeah.
I'm going to pause.
Of course,
yeah. Do you want this to be the last, I guess, back until we get
into it? I'm interested in what you guys are saying. Like, I'm
okay. I think your explanation of the state lacks nuance, and that you try to pin me down with the claim that, you know, my ideology or justifications would justify things like socialism. If you had listened to my 3 minutes of statement, you would have heard that I said that, look, obviously government can do horrible, horrible things. As you said, like Nazi Germany proves. I'm saying that a government by and for the people would avoid those ills, because that is the purest form of government. I just wanted to clarify that at the top. You mentioned government protecting interpersonal coercion through limited institutions like the prison system or the military. I am confused to how you can believe that there can be, quote, interpersonal coercion, i.e. discrimination or racism that occurred in, like, small communities like, Antebellum South, etc., and yet still reject other institutions. It seems like, to me, you can accept that, yes, there will be interpersonal coercion, and that institutions are good to resolve those instances of coercion. Therefore, the government is good. And even more than that, a powerful government is good. I do not believe that smaller states are inherently capable of providing all of the benefits of a national government. Example, Florida has a massive retirement community of almost 20,000 retirees, old age retirees. I am very hesitant to say they would be able to fend off an invasion by, let's say, the Russians or Cubans or Chinese without the help of other larger communities to support them. Again, you can cross-apply my argument about Jim Crow South. I do not believe that smaller states and communities are free. Some downtowns are an example where, in fact, smaller towns and small communities can be, in fact, more cruel and harsh to each other through things like interpersonal coercion, and is a reason why, through government action, i.e. the Voting Rights Act or the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments after the Civil War, are things that are necessary. You talk about everyone believing ordering systems. I agree with that statement. I think that that could be religion, it could be philosophy, it could be whatever, but I think that obviously as a Catholic, faith comes before all else, but I believe that a necessary ordering system for a functioning society is a government. And that's right. What I believe. So.
I think the person who's asked the question should lead and finish.
To Peter's point about Florida having a large community of retirees, you were talking about how Social Security can be structured at the smallest level of local governments. Mm-hmm. How would you propose funding Social Security for those individuals in Florida that are, if it's a community of all retirees, what's the taxpayer, what's the base providing those services to the community? Obviously, 80-year-olds that can't walk aren't going to be able to clean sewers and stuff. So what would be your suggestion for that?
Well, so I've largely been in favor of privatizing Social Security for a while. But I think...
I have objections.
Of course you do. I think generally... So what I was trying to illustrate with the Social Security example is that if we must have welfare programs administered by a state or by some form of governing body, it's best for those to be done at the smallest level as possible. Which is why I think when I'm saying communities, I mean not necessarily all the retirees are gonna agree to tax each other or not. I think that people could be drawn together by things like religion or kinship, etc., like Peter mentioned, but those communities don't necessarily need to engage in state-sponsored welfare. Whether if that is Social Security, I think that the way that you need to get there is people live in the same place as those retirees, for example. If they organize themselves into a community, I'm sure that not all the retirees are going to isolate the world outside of them. To do so would obviously foreclose the possibility of them having a Social Security. But if you were to organize yourself into a community larger than that, or that were to, or larger than just your neighborhood, or that would include retirees, that would create the possibility for democratically decided upon charities that could be in the form of
Social Security. So I guess my question to that is if you expand your community to the next neighborhood, at some point it's going to be what's the point where it's just you're okay, or is there a part where a community too big for you to be okay with, or too small for you to be okay with?
If I personally think the ideal community could be? I don't know. I'm advocating a praxis of freedom, effectively. I don't think we can lay out the blueprints for these societies effectively, because ultimately it's whatever the individuals decide, because it's not my decision. My critique of the government is a response to its numerous failings that I'm sure we'll get into later, but I'm sure we'll get into it later, but I'm not going to take a stance on what exactly the communities could look like, because, obviously, if you were to take the right libertarian kind of perspective that I am more inclined to, your community would be, basically governed by property rights. Perhaps there would be there would be institutional loyalty that would sort of create charity benefits, but all of it would not necessarily be funded by a coercive tax regime, or if it were, it would be agreed upon with almost unanimous agreement, which is not possible at the larger state level. The size of those communities could be really anything. But the distinction I'm trying to draw between larger and smaller polities is that, I mean, the most free countries are those like Switzerland and Luxembourg, and the least are the ones that are the largest. And that's generally been true throughout history. Even, I mean, Nazi Germany never really had the vast expanse of Siberia like the Russians did to enforce complete totalitarianism. Everyone's limited by size when it comes to tyranny. Go ahead, Peter.
So, claims about privatized Social Security. I ask you, Luke, what would this, would the agents, or the, I guess it would be corporations, administering Social Security, would they be, I guess, transnational? Would they be beyond, like, you can have one corporation that's, like, responsible for all these little sub-communities in Florida, and then another corporation in South Carolina? I guess my argument is, like, is it beyond just the individual community? Is there, like, potential for...
You mean to answer?
Yeah,
so basically, I think a start, because Social Security... Well, because Social Security is federal in the status quo, to privatize it in the way that I think it should be is basically, like, there can be a program where the people who pay into Social Security can opt not to pay into Social Security and instead to put their money into, like, investment or retirement accounts privately, external to, like, bureaucratic administration.
Okay.
And then they would also, in doing so, be opting out of receiving retirement benefits.
What about taxes? Taxes are voluntary under your system?
One can argue that all taxes should, or at least should, be voluntary. But under my... I think there's an argument to be made that the federal government could be funded off of donations. That's
okay.
Such as the case in the Articles of Confederation.
Oh,
we certainly don't
we
need...
Talk about that,
we don't need such a massive, like, military, which is what sucks all of our money up as of current. And most of our healthcare programs could be done at the local level, too.
It seems that a lot of your... The discussion is about the voluntary nature of programs that, you know, obviously, I think you do agree that things like Social Security can be used for good, but that it should be voluntary as to keep it good and not keep it powered by the forces of coercion. I think that, taking this from a theological standpoint, humans are naturally inclined to sin. It's concupiscence. I believe that, yes, we can do things like donations to, like, help people out. I think, like, Christian or religious charities like the Red Cross are examples of people without any benefit to themselves helping others. But I think people being willing to fully fund other people's Social Security without being forced to do so is a bit of a stretch. And that I don't think that I'm willing, like, I don't think my neighbor would be willing, without, you know, coercion, to pay taxes to sustain our military, because he or she may not think that that's, like, directly benefiting them, even if it is, which I think is a separate debate. But the voluntary nature of it just opens up people to just, like, not donating to the government. They're not going to donate to Social Security.
Yeah.
And then what happens to people then?
So I can finish this off. I think there's absolutely no reason why, to your point, you think your neighbors wouldn't donate or wouldn't give money voluntarily to the government for military. I agree, neither would I, which is why I think that maybe the government could be funded by some sort of, like, honestly, the best form of taxation that the government could engage in would be, like, a small-scale consumption tax. The IRS could easily be abolished, for sure. And I think that I think coercion is not always and everywhere wrong, but the fact that the way in which you advocate the government, that you think we need to have a government that provides all of these welfare programs, has a global military, but I think basically every single agency that the government owns could be effectively abolished, and no one would bat an eye, and if anything, the world would just become a much better place, because all of the money that's taken from you is churned through the bureaucratic system, and then put into a bunch of agencies where people are paid to not really do anything, and it wouldn't matter to them if it wouldn't matter to people who are managing them if they just like stop doing anything. I know that's not really a nuanced depiction of what goes on in government, but I want you to think, go outside, and you've mentioned, you know, inner cities, places where there are communities that could, you know, be bad. I would argue that those communities have not gotten there voluntarily. They've been results of government policies that have failed. I don't think that there's many things the government has done that have been good, and a majority of the things that they've done that have been bad are significantly worse than the level of beneficiality that has resulted from the things that they have maybe done well. I think that when we talk about taxation policy or how the government's going to fund their actions federally, I don't see a reason why taxation would be necessary, or I don't see a reason why we could not fund the government, like the military, the court system, the prison system, which is effectively all that needs to be administered federally, that why that couldn't be funded by donations, for example, which was the example that I gave, and it has been, was the case for at least the first 10 years of the government's existence. But basically every other program, if it were done at a state level or a local level, could be done via maybe a, like a form of representative government where people were elected. Taxes were, of course, implemented coercively, but at the local level, ideally, everything would operate.
All right, question. So, you've spoken to the government under the Articles of Confederation a couple times, and how it was the taxes were donation based. But and then you've also used like Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union as like examples to sort of. Poke holes in the Peter's argument, but the example you keep bringing up is like donation, but like that government only lasted 10 years and was like pretty universally seen as like a catastrophic failure, yet the system we're under on which Peter's advocated for is like lasted for 200 years. So like how do you like intellectually grapple with the fact that your example is like objectively like the one that's failed against the one that he's advocating for?
I was gonna add on, you know, there's 330 plus million people in today's society, and back, you know, in the late 1700s, we're talking a vast fraction of that. How do you expect so many people to fund the government when so many people are in outrage and you know, upset at the government each and every day with, you know, laws not being passed, gun violence, you know, abortion, things like that? What do you suggest?
You see, because all of those things that you've mentioned are only, people are only upset with the government because the government has enough power to regulate those things. If the government doesn't have a position and can't have a position because it doesn't have the power to regulate guns, to regulate abortion, for example, then that's not a problem. The government's only role would be to protect the citizenry. Now, to your point of, are there enough people, like, to fund the government? Obviously, it's much bigger now. The Articles of Confederation, like, sure, were not great. That's why they were replaced with the Constitution. But the shortcomings of the Articles of Confederation are not what I defend. The small government, the state-level power, which in my world is state and local, but basically just not federal, was where the Articles of Confederation succeeded. And I don't think that there's anything unique nowadays that would prevent a small level government that just does those few things.
Luke, when you mentioned protecting the citizens, you mentioned earlier towards Peter's rebuttal, you mentioned that the spending towards the military is outrageous, and quite frankly, don't you agree? Isn't the point of the military to protect the citizenry and you know, foreign boundaries? Isn't that the role of military?
For sure, but I don't know what a military base in Germany is doing to protect the American citizens, or at least, especially since basically all of our money in the military is overseas. The only reason that I think we need that is to prevent other countries like China, Russia, North Korea, for example, from invading America, or such as the fears that have been perpetuated by people in government. I think what's really to fear about countries attacking the United States, which engages in aggressive foreign policy, if there is no aggressive foreign policy?
I think, first on your point about the military, I think that arguments that Lucas has about the aggressive foreign policy being a self-fulfilling prophecy are straight out of a realist playbook. And realism, if for context, is a theory of international relations, essentially that because we live in a world of anarchy, i.e. all the countries are competing with each other, there's no world government, that the state states is an institution, which is ironic considering we have a libertarian defending realism, but the state as an institution has an obligation to essentially protect itself, and it is usually not associated with institutions. So a realist would not say we should join the UN. I think that point of view about us being too aggressive, I think the point of our military budget about protecting us is pretty clearly proven by the fact that where the United States military goes as an institution, right, the military, we of course have far from a perfect track record, but I'm talking about Europe and Asia here. We are likely the only thing that prevented Russia from rolling Ukraine down. And the European governments, which you would probably see as coercive too, the European governments were also responsible for protecting Ukraine from Russia attacking them. Same with Taiwan and Japan and South Korea, which all want our help to protect them from a potential Chinese invasion. Yes, could the military budget be cut for efficiency's sake? Maybe. I think there's a valid argument to that. But the argument that we don't need forward projection is just not true, because I think that leads into my a broader argument that to embrace the government as a necessary force in society is not only the logical option, as I've outlined before, it's also the ethical option, because the government, dare I say, is the institution that protects the common good and protects the person or the people that other people don't want to have any business in protecting. We've seen this through amendments for voting rights for women, for African Americans, the abolition of slavery, the expansion of voting rights to non-property owning males, giving Native Americans citizenship, protecting other countries from military invasion. Those are all what the state can do, whereas a retirement home in Florida can't do that, or a neighborhood community in Oakland, California, consisting of 100 people, can't do that. I think we can both agree, state governments have done horrible things. But my defense of the state comes from a defense of the Constitution and that it's a representative government. I think the American style of government, this democratic experiment, is the greatest form of government humanity has ever seen, quite frankly. And I'm not going to defend Nazi Germany, I'm not going to defend communist Russia, but I will defend the Constitution, which I think, when you're looking at this debate historically, I think what Ben was saying was absolutely correct. You're looking at the Articles of the Confederation versus the Constitution, and one of which we have today, and the other one died and went extinct hundreds of years ago. So
I can close that up.
Yeah, so Peter, I want to quick hit on your realism point. I don't think I'll take a stance on whether or not I'm defending realism. And I certainly think when I say things like countries that we perceive as threats are only threats to us because we have provoked them, that's not necessarily a realist point of view. Now, I don't think I would indict liberal institutionalism. I think like the UN and NATO, for example, I think they can exist. The problem that I take with the government is not in the way that it cooperates for our safety, but the way in which it imposes itself on the citizenry. So the argument that you made, I don't think this is a question of the Articles of Confederation versus the Constitution, because I'm not defending the Articles of Confederation. I think that there are things under the Articles of Confederation that have been good. And obviously there are things in the Constitution that are bad, and I don't think that you will defend everything about it in the way that I won't defend everything about the Articles of Confederation. But I don't think embracing the government as you put it, whatever that means, is necessary, because I don't think it is ethical. You've listed things like citizenship and protecting us from wars that have been good, and I'll agree with that. But the government had to get there from a starting point. The government, what is the government but just a bunch of people who have organized themselves for the people?
Well, who organized them?
People.
Yeah, they were elected there.
Yes, people organized themselves to enact policies in the favor of the people. But the problem is when those people become corrupt and they only want what's in their favor. And that happens in the world of a large government, which you have explicitly advocated. I think the protection of freedoms through military, sure, couldn't be done by a residential community in Florida, has to be done by a federal government. That's why I think we need a federal government to do those things. But we don't need a government that extends its arm across into every single interpersonal relationship, that steals our money and funnels it into military bases globally, that puts surveillance machines in your home, Peter. I don't think we need to...
Well, that would be unconstitutional, which I wouldn't defend.
Oh, okay.
So.
Sorry. I forgot that you're a diehard constitutionalist, Mr. Hamilton.
Well, again, right, like you said, I'm not defending everything constitutional.
We can move on.
But, yeah, I understand your point.
All Thank right. you, Peter.
Well, we've asked a lot of questions, I think, your viewpoint, so I'm just going to... Peter, you're open with your defense of the United States Constitution, and then your last point was hammering home your belief in the Constitution. So you made a point that the U.S. government is like the most democratic in the world, but many would argue like disenfranchises a lot of voter, a mm-hmm. huge voter base. The president is like half the people in the country don't like him, mm-hmm. right? Just the way the whole system's set up, do you think it's like, how do you grapple with the fact that objectively there are more democratic, like measurable democratic countries in Europe, and do you think that those parts of the Constitution should be changed, or do you just believe it's how it is now, and that's the Constitution, everything else I agree with, so I'm just going to keep going with that.
I think valid criticisms of the American representative system of democracy, like the Electoral College, or popular vote versus, you know, state representative vote, I think those arguments can be countered just by the fact that I made a claim in my article that the state is the only thing that can correct the state's mistakes. What that means is that only the government can correct what the government does wrong, even though I think the government ultimately does more good than wrong, but beside the point, I think that, yes, there are current inequities in the system. I think those are going to be far less of a deal than if we embrace a limited form of government where we have states openly competing with each other and where we have a federal government specifically, that is so toothless that it can't resolve internal disputes and it can't do things like have a Center for Disease Control when there's a virus that goes around, i.e. COVID-19, which under Luke's framework for government would no longer exist, and the states would have to deal with that. I think the second part of my argument, though, is that the government can reform itself and make itself better, right? We started out with the Constitution of property-owning white males having the right to vote. That changed in 1820 with the abolition of property requirements, then in 1865 with allowing black males to vote, and then citizenship was given to African-American males, and then by 1920, women earned the right to vote. I think that we can institute similar reforms to address concerns that people have with today's democracy, i.e. through constitutional amendments, which are not as hard, which while being hard to do, are absolutely possible with a functioning democracy, which I still think we do have. I think the fact is we still have multiple tiers of representative officials, from the president to your local city council members, and if people are in fact riled up, they can make their voice heard through a democracy and can make their desires for what they want their government to be heard at the national level. That's why when we have, right, when Trump got elected in 2016, what happened in 2018 in the midterms? A blue wave. Well, it was essentially just the House flipped back to the Democrats, right? When Biden got elected, what happened in 2022? It was a Republican surge that saw them win back the House. So that's the people letting their voice be heard. people are always going to be disgruntled. People are always going to be angry. That's kind of why I said that people are, we're all imperfect. Again, if we were angels, we wouldn't have any need for government, essentially. But we're all imperfect in our own ways. We all have a tendency to have errors of judgment. And in my opinion, the government is the best way to correct those errors in judgment. Through the election of people.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I'll ask a clarifying question, Peter. You said that you would defend, like, the government as it is now, include the two-party system.
I think the two-party system is a result of the American voters. Now, personally, I don't see a problem with more than two parties. I like to have the idea of, like, a Ross Perot, who in 1992 won, like, 24% of the popular vote, which was interesting and quite frankly, I guess, like, inspiring, I guess, for people who don't follow the traditional two-party system dogma.
You know who was hitting double digits in 2016 polls for his party for the first time in a while?
Gary Johnson. Okay, yeah. Well, I guess in that case, it seems like the people were casting their throwing their hat behind a third-party candidate.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think we can both agree that that's a good thing.
Sure, yeah.
Or we could have four parties or five or whatever the people want.
Yeah.
Because the people chose the government. And so that's, you know.
Yeah.
Any more points on that, or we good?
I think we're in agreement there.
I don't think we are in agreement.
for the multiple parties,
I think we've reached a conclusion. That's
okay. Good question.
I lost it.
I mean, I can certainly.
I'll think about it.
I can certainly respond to your government reforms away all its problems.
Absolutely, go ahead.
Yeah, so government has to create those problems first, right? I mean, where does the inequality come from? And when I say inequality, I'm not talking materially. I'm talking, like, in terms of legal rights, there are shortcomings in where the government discriminates against certain people. And, Peter, I think if your defense of the current government were true, we wouldn't have a lot of these problems right now. But we do, and we have, since basically its creation. And there hasn't been a constitutional convention that has legislated away all oppressive rights or oppression of rights by the government. Empirically, it's just not happened. And I think the system empirically that has provided the most freedoms, the most equality for people in society has been capitalism. And my problem with the government when it comes to rights is that it's not voluntary. It almost never is. Everything that's done by the government is agreed upon by a select few of representatives, which don't always get the majority vote. If 51% of people said we should kill the other 49% democratically, that would make sense. But in a world where everybody is driven by profit motive or by contractual agreements that are agreed upon between individuals privately and without external coercion from the biggest military in the world, we can implicitly reach a sort of equilibrium where society becomes the most equal, which is to say that every person has control over their own bodies.
What protects the 51% from killing the 49%.
Profit motive, the invisible hand of the market, Peter. And I know that that's not what Adam Smith would have said necessarily. He wouldn't have said we need laissez-faire capitalism, but that invisible hand certainly does prevent terrible things from happening to people. There are companies that exist, and I want you to think about the gravity of this, because this isn't really something that's talked about. There are literally companies that exist because of the profit motive to give to you insurance, that insurance being that if something bad happens to you, they will pay for it. And that's only happened because they can gain a profit from it. The government can't give you insurance. The government can claim that they can, but then they end up with bankrupt Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That is a result of capitalism and capitalism alone. System of free markets.
I disagree with your notion of the profit motive preventing people from killing each other. I think the existence of the military-industrial complex proves that there are, in fact, corporations with the vested interest in selling weapons that can be used to kill people, and they, in fact, profit off of it. And that would happen regardless of whether or not there's a government, because there would be... What would Blackwater and Wagner do? Blackwater and Wagner, which are private corporations, would still buy those weapons.
Peter, companies exist only if they can make money. The people who are buying from these companies are the government. The military-industrial complex, as a concept, is Congress funneling infrastructure, military infrastructure projects through itself so that it can get money funneled into the government, into the industrial complex. That is not something that happens in a world of free markets, because there's not a profit incentive. If the government only has a military and doesn't have enough power to wield the military-industrial complex, there's no incentive for a private individual to go buy a military, and it shouldn't be legal.
So, but that's coercion right there. You're not letting somebody
have
their own.
Yes,
military.
It's coercion, but it's not. We spend almost all of our money, trillions of dollars,
okay,
more than
the
next five countries
in existence
on our military budget.
The existence of private military companies doesn't disprove that corporations would still be purchasing weapons en masse?
It doesn't. It has no relation to your argument that companies will, like, I don't know, I think what you're alluding to is that companies will just buy a bunch of guns and then kill us all or something.
Well, I'm just saying that your argument that the MIC only exists because of the government, the government is certainly an actor in that, but again, first of all, government can reform itself to distance itself from the MIC through the popular vote. Second, corporations would make it
an but that's the problem.
Way, so.
It hasn't, and it doesn't, and I don't think it ever will. The only way to achieve that is a restructuring of the government in totality. The profit, like, sure, everybody is going to be greedy. Like, everyone's going to want to be more powerful than everybody else. That's why you end up with corrupt government. But only capitalism provides checks and balances on that through the private motive.
I guess my question to you is, like, historically, when there has been this sort of ability for companies, themselves, like Peter's saying, to sort of have their own military, like the Portuguese would go in and take over like small ports and stuff. Like, what's to stop if Amazon wants to go build a headquarters somewhere in some faraway place? What's to stop them from purchasing up all these guns, funding their own private military to kill people for their own profit gains? And is that morally? Are you morally okay with a company doing that and funding their own private venture to kill people if it's for the profit and everyone in their own community is okay with that?
No. So I don't think the community thing ties into this, because this is a question of, like, what companies will do in a free market as opposed to, like, the public realm, which is what the institutions would be. I am not saying that profit outweighs people's lives. I'm saying that the profit motive is what creates innovation, creates higher public standard of living. I mean, I think we can all agree that since capitalism has happened or has become relevant factor in the world, poverty's decreased, general legal inequality has decreased, rights have increased globally. We've become generally more democratic in a good way, even despite the failures of the system now, which is what, of course, we're debating about. I don't think it makes sense for a company to go and just, like, I mean, I don't even, like, what, I mean, there's not an example where a company would just go buy, like, fund a military and just start killing people, because that doesn't make, like, logical sense. The reason I'm defending free market capitalism is because what the companies will do is in the interest of, like, a profit. That, of course, like, just slaughtering people is not going to make you money. But if, like, killing people would be the byproduct of, like, for example, there are corporations like Nestle or De Beers Diamond Company that have, like, or it's not even really Nestle, it's just the companies that have contracted out, that have, like, that have engaged in malpractice and abuse. And, of course, that's terrible. And I don't think that that should be legal, and I think that that's something where governments are actually necessary to rally around. But, like, I'd like to point out, in the instance of the De Beers Diamond Company, the only reason that they have that power, and the only reason that those local companies that are contracted out in Africa actually have that power, is because, A, De Beers Diamond Company to begin with was given its corporate monopoly by the Soviet Union through a system of contractual agreements by a government in Africa, and now just has, it's not necessarily a monopoly, but it certainly has an extreme amount of power, and it's almost unchallenged because there's no governing body that's willing to do anything about it, and it's only been given that power by government. Generally, I think that the what we call market failures are either not really market failures and only results of the government, or are just not really problems to begin with, and we just identify them as such from hysteria. But that's not the case with what you pointed out.
I have one clarifying question, and then if y'all have any more, go ahead, and then we can move on maybe concluding remarks. But I think that I have a brief question. You said that, in your opinion, profit motive should not outweigh human life, correct?
I don't think a company getting money is a better thing than somebody living.
What power prevents that from not being true? What prevents Nestle from prioritizing human welfare over the abilities of its constituents?
Well, the only responsibility, the only social responsibility of a corporation should be to pay off its shareholders. But when the way that companies do that becomes coercive by nature, then that's where the government needs to step in. And that's why I think that a government that's not incredibly powerful, but is the only one that wields like military coercive power, only to use that in like limited ways, is good.
Well, this was fun. I've never done a debate affiliated podcast. Most of what we do is just, you know, community profiles, reflections. I really, really enjoyed this, and I hope we do this hopefully soon.
Yeah,
what do you got?
Really nice to have you guys on. I feel like I learned a lot of different opinions about libertarianism, but glad to hear someone else's voice. It's always good to challenge yourself and challenge your views. Unless you guys have anything to say, plug the debate team, plug the roundup, whatever you want.
Oh no, you go first.
Go for it.
Well, you know, I'm in the roundup. Didn't say that at the beginning, but you know, it's cool.
I get
winner's passes. I have to do a lot of work in my English classes, but okay, I'm only partly joking, because also, you know, Dr. Deegan's a cool dude. Dr. Deegan wanted Peter and I to do this, and
shout out to our debate coaches
for being okay with us having such extreme political views, and then also sharing them on a random roundup podcast. So,
remember, kids, if you're ever irate, trust the state. All right. Have fun, y'all.
I know you plan to say that. Okay, I like it. All right, guys.
Thank you so much for having us. It means a lot.
It's great to have you guys on.
Good debate, man.
We have another episode in the next coming weeks. Maybe a teacher profile.
Hey, stay tuned. Currently, Ben and I just recently two seniors. Are a part of the STARS Southwestern program for medicine. Anton Demofelix and Dawson Zavala were nominated and presented their projects in the Melsheimer Family Theater, and we are going to cover that in our next episode, so stay tuned. Thank you to Peter and Luke for stopping by and giving us one heck of a time, and we'll see y'all next time.
Adios.
Peace out.